We're going to discuss the gatekeepers today.
Yep, let's roll with that one, and we can talk about the ever cycling pandemic propaganda.
Yeah, I was actually speaking to Anthony earlier this week, and I was telling him about the fact that every 30 years or so we've got a pandemic, and it doesn't seem to end. It's a never-ending cycle, and I mean, I'm trying to figure out how the hell we're going to get to the bottom of this thing and stop the cycle. And for me, yeah, I mean, the most important work that I feel we should do is to point out the gatekeepers. I don't know how you feel about that.
Oh, I feel great about that. You know how I feel about that. I think.
Yeah,
that,
so.
Go ahead, brother.
No, I just, for people listening and who don't know about the page that we put up, it's called the Gatekeepers Club. And I mean, I didn't realize how massive this is until I started digging into this. And it's only after I wasted a few months of my time following the information that Jody Mijovic put out. But yeah, I mean, I'm not here to make criteria for people themselves to point these people out. I've also written an article to say you must get your own criteria. But for me, and I think for a lot of people in this movement, the no virus topic is a very easy gatekeeper tell. So yeah, I've made a list of all of this, all of the people that's shilling the virus lie, and it ties in with the ever repeating pandemic cycle. Because if you can just get past this virus lie, the fact that there is no viruses, then we'll easily squash out this pandemic cycle.
Well, what I think is curious, right, is that all over the mainstream media propaganda machine, right, because that's how all this shit is perpetuated. Let's not ever forget that, you know. That's the true virus, if we want to talk about viruses. But there's like these news articles cropping up that say scientists are like developing vaccines against a new pandemic. Please explain to me how the ever-loving fuck you can develop a vaccine without having your quote-unquote new virus. You know what I mean? That's not possible. So they're just making shit up, which they've been doing the whole time. The entire field of virology is a quack pseudoscience. So it's just funny to me, like if you haven't got past it before, or you were still on the fence, and if you even have like a rudimentary amount of knowledge about the workings of how virology, about how it works, why would you see something like that and not have the common sense to think that, you know what I mean? They're developing a vaccine against a new pandemic. Well, the pandemic hasn't even hit. And so for anyone who doesn't know, in order to create a vaccine, you have to have a quote unquote virus and isolate it, which they do not do, and use that to make your vaccine. So how could you do that when you don't even know what it is? And that's why they're calling it Disease X and things like that. They're just leaving room for this shit. They've already had the legislation for a while now, and it's all part of their weird ushering in of, you know, digital ID, digital surveillance. They want to be able to basically use whatever disease X is going to be. It could be anything. I don't think they've even identified it. They just keep throwing shit out there to try to see what creates the most hype and the most fear porn and see what sticks to the wall. 100%.
Yeah, it's actually comical, because I've seen two videos of, I think it's a CEO of Pfizer going around that said they developed the vaccine back in the day only based on a computer sequence. So they didn't have a sample of a virus or anything. They just used the sequence of this virus and they developed the vaccine. I think TJ's got the videos. I just got my channel tanked recently, so I wouldn't have links to those videos. But yeah, it's very funny. I mean, we're way past the point of still debating viruses. We've done that for a year, and I think there's more than enough evidence to see that there ain't anything close to what they describe as being a virus. But yeah, I'm just really interested in finding a way to break this cycle, because
the reason I wanted to end right now with all of our fucking accounts getting tanked the way that they have been. I've noticed a pattern, not just in our circle, but in other circles as well. And I know we got people like the Mutton Trolls going around making coordinated efforts, trying to get rid of accounts and stuff. We've seen it happen to you. It happened to Discern. It's happened to several people. And I think that they're trying their hardest to stifle this conversation and, you know, other conversations. You can't talk about the medical machine. You can't talk about who actually runs things. You can't talk about lots of stuff. So I think there's a coordinated effort, not by just the trolls, but by the actual, you know, Twitter X machine itself to really silence and stifle a lot of this conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And that was also funny. I mean, the guy, I was having an argument with one of these trolls, but you can see the guy, he's got like no followers and following 20 people. And he actually threatened my life. And I reported the clown and nothing happened to his account. And the next morning I woke up and my account was gone. So it's kind of funny how they get away with blatant breaking Twitter rules, and then you need to guess why you lost your account.
Yes, and they're bragging about it. They think it's funny, which, I mean, honestly, I just block them all. I don't play with their bullshit. It's a waste of fucking time trying to deal with those people when they're trying to make those kind of coordinated efforts. I recommend everyone else does the same before they nuke your shit too.
Yeah, no, I'm over debating the Mutton Code trolls. If I see them now, just say insta block. But yeah, I mean, getting back to the subject, the reason why I wanted to chat to Anthony is actually he was involved with the AIDS dissident movement back in the 80s and 90s. And I mean, yeah, I mean, we all think it's been so long ago, but that he calls it a civil war went on up to, I think, 2011, when Eleni actually said herself that the gatekeepers during that era destroyed the AIDS dissident movement. So yeah, I actually wanted to ask the guy, because it's intriguing. I mean, we've got these guys like Anthony Brink and Rod Knoll, and yeah, we've got a whole new movement now with a lot of new characters, and nobody's ever asked these oaks to come on their show or be interviewed by these people. And it's my opinion that we can learn a lot from them. But if you ask Anthony and you go through their story, you would see that it's actually been a very and yeah, you know, I mean, Anthony would explain it himself as a brutal war, where these people have started or they tried their utmost best. Well, they tried. They actually succeeded at the end of the day to smear this AIDS dissident movement with a bunch of horse shit. And the most prominent one was probably the theory of Peter Duisberg with his harmless virus theory. And yeah, I mean, in contrast to that, there was Eleni's work, a brilliant work on HIV, which was the most feared virus at the time. But nobody shed any light on that. They just focused on Peter Duisberg's work, as well as Kerry Mullis, and David Rasnick was actually the guy in charge of all of this, arranging more exposure to these people that actually had a shit theory. But yeah, I mean, the reason why I actually wanted to get Anthony on is to chat more about this, so we can figure out what to do to avoid the same happening to our movement. So I don't know if you've got any theories, but you know, one of the main reasons I wanted to write that the Gatekeepers Club was for people to start seeing what the gatekeepers do and who they are.
Yeah, and see, this is the thing, is the difference between what Eleni and Duisberg had said. You know, Eleni actually shows that, you know, Montagnier and Gallo, none of them had isolated shit, right? the germ theory really should have died out back then. And the problem is that I agree with you that this is important to call out these gatekeepers, because I think that what's happening and what continues to happen is that we trade one set of theories from, you know, the people who won't look at this at all, and we get rid of them, and then we take people who are looking at this and we put them on a pedestal, okay? And then it suddenly becomes taboo for you or myself or anyone else to question them, because now that they've been put on said pedestal, they are the new guru, and people feel very sensitive and defensive about critiquing them. And I think it's important to remember that how the fuck did we get stuck in this cycle in the first place? It's by basically burying your head in the sand, refusing to look at patterns and associations and things like that. And I also think, before we get a little deeper into this, because I know this is something that will get, you know, thrown back in our face, it's important to make the concession and realize that no, not everybody is a gatekeeper. Okay. But in the matter of the public eye and discussion, I would go as far as saying probably about 90% of these motherfuckers are. Okay. And if you have a platform, if you just came out of nowhere in 2020 and all of a sudden you're allowed to speak about this while other people aren't, that right there is a red flag. Okay. And so, yes, it is important to realize that no, not everybody is a controlled op. I think some people are actually just very either willfully or unwillfully stupid and not realizing that they're being used as a tool by some of these controlled op people. And they've allowed them to infiltrate their circle and their spaces and become a part of the things that they're hosting or being a part of. And they're kind of a useful idiot at this point. And that's just as damaging. You know what I mean? Ignorance like that is also very dangerous. It's infighting can be addressed. You know what I mean? If someone has something to say, usually you can just hash it out and get to the bottom of it. But when people ignore the things that are being said or kind of just laugh it off and pretend it's not, that to me is like a nervous laughter. You know what I mean? Like, what the fuck do you have to hide? Or they won't even address it at all. They're just kind of tiptoeing around the subject and trying to make other people look a certain type of way because they don't want to actually address the things that they've said or put out there, because they might realize that they might have to, you know, let go of their ego and say, well, fuck, I was wrong, or apologize, or something like that, which is the right thing to do. You know what I mean? So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, if I'm wrong, I'm open to say, you know what, shit, I made a mistake, because other people read this stuff and they listen to these interviews. And if you put an idea in people's head that might harm them, then obviously, We're here to help people get to the truth. Not that I say that everything I put out there is always correct, but if you know that something is a mistake, then obviously the first thing I would do is say, shit, I made a mistake, and this is actually what I think about this stuff. But it goes a lot deeper than that, and I also spoke to Anthony about this earlier this week. And I mean, if you put an idea out there, like let's say you're part of the no virus crew and you carry this message of there are no viruses, which is, I mean, it's an easily proven fact. And then together with that, you advocate for something like ivermectin or vitamin D or all of this other horseshit as a preventative medicine. And people, they don't always go into as much detail as you do. So they believe you on the no virus front, but then they also believe you on this preventative medicine or shit, and then they adjust their life to incorporate this truth of no virus into their life, but they drink these preventative medicines and they get sick at the end of the day. Then they're gonna believe your whole story is a bunch of horseshit. So it's difficult to draw the line of where the gatekeepers are and where they are not, when it's actually an earnest mistake. But if you refuse, in my view, to correct your mistake, then obviously you're pushing harmful information out there, and it's not going to help our message.
And here's the thing: everybody does learn at their own pace. You know what I mean? So that's fine. But if the information gets dropped in front of you, and again, this is why I said earlier, you kind of just laugh it off, which I've had experience with, and I know you have too, where they kind of just think that, again, this is ego at play. Like they just think that they're better than somebody. They know better than somebody. Oh, you're a peon. How could you possibly know this? You know, they're just laughing it off, or they're coming up with like these euphemisms that make no sense. And, you know, it's just very, it can get frustrating because, you know, people want to defend this kind of shit, and you're pointing out to them, well, actually I have presented this information to the person. I gave them ample time to sit on it, make a decision, do whatever. And they're still choosing to ignore it and go down a certain path. And, there are times where there are monetary or financial incentives involved. So, they have to question themselves, what's more important, causing someone harm or making a couple bucks on the side? And we all know what the answer should be. But that's not always the case. And that's what's fucked up is then when you point this out, you get attacked, and that's not right. If nobody should be held on that pedestal to the point where they're not subject to the same scrutiny as everybody else. And if I'm caught doing this, by all means, tear me a new asshole. Tell me I'm wrong. Give me the information. And if I don't do something about it, it's probably something to be concerned about. You know what I mean? But that's, I don't have that issue. You know what I mean? If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And I think that that's how we learn. And that's how we keep each other intellectually honest. You know, if you're not willing to do that, then you shouldn't even have a fucking platform. You shouldn't be giving people advice. You shouldn't be having these discussions. You shouldn't be a so-called truther or whatever the hell you want to call it. You know what I mean? You obviously don't have the stones for it.
Yeah, and second to that, another example of this is somebody like Stefan Lonke, he keeps the message clean, and the Perth group, they only spoke about, the Perth group probably not as pertinent as Stefan Lonke, but their message was there is no virus at the end of the day. And I hear a lot of people say, but yeah, a person like David Icke says the same. But my intention is to try and get the message out there and for people to actually realize this truth. And you can now just imagine that, let's say you approach a person in two ways. The first way is you only tell them about no virus and the fact that this is a very good stepping stone for good health and where they can go and look for more information. And let's say, I don't know exactly what the stats are, but let's say 2 out of 10 people would believe you and go and actually look into this stuff. But now the second avenue is you tell them, you know what, David Icke has got a lot of truth, and he also sells the message of no virus. And just by the way, he thinks the world is run by lizard people and greys and all kinds of other shit. So in that instance, nobody would go and look at that, because they would think you're nuts. So it's very important to, in my view, to try and keep the message clean. Otherwise, you're not going to get the message out there. And that's actually what I'm trying to do, is get people to realize this truth. Otherwise, I wouldn't be wasting my time with trying to make other people see.
Yeah, Anthony joined us. You wanna get him up here?
Yeah, I just sent him in. Send him an invite.
While you're doing that, we're talking about people like David Icke. Did he not recently endorse, what is it? I think it's McCullough that owns the wellness company.
Yeah, that's it. I kind of went hardcore against that because he's also a virus pusher, McCullough. So I don't know why he would be endorsing McCullough.
That's the kind of weird stuff they keep doing. And this is what keeps people guessing and on the fence. You know what I mean? That is exactly what a good gatekeeper does. And people don't see that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. Anthony, can you hear us?
I sure can.
Good morning.
Hey, howdy, everybody.
Yeah, so it's already in the afternoon this side, Kristen.
I've just come in. I've just come in, so I missed what's gone on before. So I'm kind of coming in cold here. So TPL, Dirk, if anything you want me to canvas, you know, fire your questions.
Yeah, so Anthony, the topic...
I don't want to break the flow either, you know.
Yeah, so the topic of this talk is actually we wanted to discuss the ever-repeating cycle of pandemics since the 1920s. And the fact that we keep on repeating history and not learning from that. And I thought that seeing as you came out of one prior to the COVID hoax, which is the HIV hoax, you would be able to give us some insights as to what to look out for to try and get the message out there and teach people how to break free from this lie.
Yeah. Well, I can't do better than point up an observation that Eleni Papadopoulos Iliopoulos made, which was that politics, you know, this thing might be mostly politics. You could even say it's sort of, you know, 99% politics, because of such powerful forces are arraigned in this matter. But it's critical to get the kernel, the scientific kernel of the struggle correct. And you know, you can move to politics after that. But if you haven't got the basic line correct, you're gonna fail. So she was very big on being clear headed, like you said a minute ago, being clear headed in what you're saying, in what you're conveying, not selling any kind of a corrupted line. Getting it straight, getting it clear, and then fighting, you know, from that line. She was very strong with that. Of course, she was absolutely correct. And it was the failure of the Rethinking AIDS crowd under David Crowe's sort of leadership or stewardship or whatever, his control. It was their failure to grasp this that caused so much damage and so much lost time.
Yeah, absolutely. To add to that too, Anthony, is, you know, when you speak about politics being involved in a lot of this, before you had come on, I had mentioned the involvement of, you know, like the media. And, you know, we have things like, you know, here in the States, at least, we had, you know, Pfizer, the CDC director, Moderna, BlackRock, Vanguard, all these different entities and institutes that were all behind the fake COVID agenda. Yeah. And that largely contributed, in my opinion, to the kind of frenzy and things. And like when this kind of stuff happens, people don't think, you know what I mean? So it's very easy for them to allow a lie to take hold in that way. And you kind of have to, you know, go in and like, you know, bring them back up from being underwater, so to speak, you know, because they've been drowning in nonsense and lies and sensationalism. And they have to kind of work their way back out of that. And it's a very powerful tool and a powerful mechanism. And what I wanted to ask you was, would you say that back in your time around the AIDS dissident movement that you've seen some of the same stuff, but perhaps people weren't as hip or privy to it because we weren't on the internet as much as we are now. And I think people share more of that kind of stuff now between or amongst each other and are able to point it out. Like, look at us right here. You know, we're having a Twitter space about this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's an important tool?
Just to steal a question from me, Kristen. What's precisely what you want me to talk to?
Yeah, no. So do you think that the difference between then and now is that we have those tools to kind of share information more with each other, and instead of using them in that way, it's being kind of used against us?
Used against us. I don't know. I'm not sure it's that different. I mean, in my sort of in the HIV/AIDS era, as it were, we were using email, telephones, and the occasional conference. Sure, the technology's come a long way. We've got Twitter, X Spaces, and so forth. But I don't. I'm not sure that we have that the enemy has changed, or the power of the media has changed in relation to the the opposing forces. Because I mean, we have the full brunt of the media against us, but mainstream media, print media. I'm not sure that there have been any radical shifts there.
So, Anthony, I hear you say it's mainly been driven by politics. What do you mean by it's driven by politics? Because the way I see it is, none of this would be possible if they don't mostly drive the stuff through the media.
You're very correct about that. When I'm referring to politics, I wasn't referring to when I raised the matter of the politics of it, I was alluding to our internal politics, not the balance of forces as against the pharmaceutical industry and its investor groups and all that stuff. I was talking about getting, when we go out, when we sally out on our horses or our lances, as it were, to take on the forces against us. The pharma industry, the medical industrial complex, and so on. When we go out, it's terribly important that we use the sharpest tools. This is Eleni's point, that we have our we line up our best possible arguments, not our dullest arguments. So when I'm talking about the politics and the science and the ratio, I'm not putting this very eloquently, but the gist of it is that it was critical to get the scientific facts as we knew them, to present them as clearly and as honestly as possible, and then think about, okay, now how can we take on the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industrial complex generally? You know what I mean? So she was saying, no, we Eleni would say, I accept that a lot of this has to do with politics and so on, but let's get the science straight. I think it might also, she may have had in mind the fact that Crowe and his harmless virus position, which was a cynical position because he knew better. I think she had in mind their contention that it was best to go in soft with like half truths, because the full truth would be too much to sell. You get me? In other words, Crowe and his crowd thought it'd be easier to sell HIV as a harmless virus, just as it might in our time be easier to sell so-called SARS-CoV-2 as a not so bad virus, as opposed to, well, there's no virus at all. That was their position. So she just agreed. She said, no, you don't go in with anything. You must go in with everything you've got scientifically. Sell the truth as hard, and then as hard as you can. Don't go and don't obfuscate the scientific facts as you know them. Yeah.
But Anthony, what do you say went wrong? Because yeah, I can't imagine that there'll ever be another Eleni in this space. I mean, she even managed to publish a few papers herself. I think she published a dozen papers in the peer-reviewed literature. But still, you guys almost made almost no headway. So, what do you say went wrong, more or less?
Oh, interesting. Well, let's rewind the video again a little bit, and let me remind you that when you say we made no headway, we won over a head of state in the person of Thabo Mbeki. Okay, we won over the Secretary General of the ANC at the time, later briefly president, Chalema Motlanthe. By the way, you know, both of whose offices contacted me after I'd reached Mbeki with AZT. But in any case, we Trevor Manuel was completely on board. He knew that there was no virus. So the top intellectuals in government were well aware, thanks to Eleni and my agitation around HIV/AIDS, so-called. I mean, we won them. But then what happened was, after Mbeki convened his the first meeting of his International AIDS Advisory Panel, Bill Clinton declared AIDS a threat to the AIDS in Africa, not AIDS generally, but AIDS in Africa, a threat to the national security of the United States of America. Now, that's a hell of a thing to do, because this triggers, you know, no holds barred engagement. And they were just, it was as if Mbeki's original dissension from the orthodoxy being sold by the medical industrial complex, it was as if it just got swept away by the overwhelming power of the medical industrial complex, its reach into politics at the highest levels of American government, and its reach, of course, into all the media. So when you say what went wrong, it was just like a tsunami came our way and just swept us away like so many twigs. I mean, even sweeping aside, for Christ's sake, even sweeping aside, you know, a head of state of an important African country. So what went wrong? An enormous surge, a counterstrike, just swept us out the way. If I recall correct, if I got the chronology, the history, the order correct, it was after that that the Rethinking AIDS crowd under Crow picked up, if I remember correct. Yeah, it was much later, indeed. And then, you know, instead of standing on the success we had achieved with winning Mbeki over, they retreated into this no virus position, knowing better, but thinking it was more, you know, sellable. And quite simply, no progress was made after that. I'm not pretending that had they stuck to Eleni's line, you know, we could have changed the world after the reversal that we suffered in 2000, where it began with Mbeki holding up his hand and saying, okay, stop, we need to look at this AZT. But I mean, a few months later, our country was settled with the biggest ARV, antiretroviral drug program in the world. Such is the power of the medical industrial complex, and especially a big pharma. So these are the things that happened.
Can I ask a question, Anthony?
Yeah, yeah. Please.
Was this happening around the time that Eleni published the AIDS in Africa issue? Do you think that it had anything to do with that?
Do I think what had anything to do with that?
That like you were saying, when someone like Bill Clinton was saying stuff about, you know, that in Africa being a threat here in the United States, did that happen around the same time? And do you think maybe it was because it was, you know, something to do with trying to discredit or silence that published work by Eleni?
No, it wasn't. I don't think that Bill Clinton reacted to any particular paper, and not that paper, and especially not that paper. No.
Okay.
What the American administration was reacting to was Mbeki's vocal, you know, express dissension from HIV/AIDS orthodoxy, which was immensely threatening to the financial interests of Big Pharma, because the ARV wing of Big Pharma was massive, and it was like a new opportunity. In the same way that Big Pharma made so much money out of COVID with its vaccination scheme, well, in the HIV/AIDS era, it was all about selling ARVs. So the more they could keep this myth of HIV/AIDS going, and the more they could propagate it in Africa using South Africa as a portal market, the more money for them, the more profit. And what Mbeki was doing was he was directly challenging the sort of the business model, as it were, of ARV medicine. He was challenging the medical model, which was like the business model. The medical model being that there's a virus out there jumping between our genitals, and we're all going to die unless we swallow these potent, expensive drugs. So Mbeki had to be shut down because he was threatening the financial interests of the pharmaceutical industry. And the most dangerous, of course, the sharpest threat to the whole thing was Eleni's critique of HIV/AIDS orthodoxy. There's this notion that HIV is a virus that causes AIDS, but she was saying there is no virus. So you might be interested to learn. Yeah, but let me just get this in. You might be interested to learn that she didn't attend the first meeting of Mbeki's AIDS panel. And the talk in the corridors that I remember quite distinctly was that she was afraid or concerned for her personal security. That's why she didn't come out for the first meeting. Now, that might have just been unfounded gossip, but I remember that was a sort of like the somber talk, that she didn't feel secure, didn't feel safe to actually catch an airplane and fly over the water and land in this country to make her case. Interesting.
Yeah, so Anthony, I think you mentioned that Mbeki, I think it was 7 or 9 months afterwards, lost his presidency. Do you think it was because of that controversy?
I've heard some analysts express that view. I've captured it somewhere in some of my writing. It's recorded somewhere. No, I don't think it was the direct cause. It could have been, but I think he lost his presidency in a straight up power struggle, internal power struggle in the African National Congress. In other words, when Mbeki fell, when Mbeki was ousted, and by the way, I was following the whole shit very closely at the time. You know, I really was tracking this thing very closely. And I wasn't personally persuaded that he was ousted on account of his position on HIV/AIDS, more especially because he'd already been defeated on HIV/AIDS. The country was like a ship that had gone off a course and had been brought back onto the desired course, the course desired by the medical industrial complex. So the country was back on track, and Mbeki had already been completely sidelined and silenced in regard to HIV/AIDS. So, bumping him off politically by ousting him, it was kind of unnecessary. He no longer posed a threat to Big Pharma and medical industrial complex.
Yeah. So Anthony, on another note, I wanted to ask you because, I mean, talking to you and Rocknell and also reading your work, you can hear some of the frustrations of what you guys had to go through by not getting support. I think it was like 10 people at most supporting the Perth group at the end of the day. And till today, I mean, can I just ask you to mute when you're not speaking, because there is some background noise from your speaker. So, I mean, one of the things that frustrated me the most is the fact that I started really getting on top of the Perth group and getting out information about them, because I mean, the work that Eleni and the group did is just unbelievable. I mean, a breakdown of the 2997 papers is just, I mean, that alone should have destroyed virology. And what frustrated me in the months after that is the fact that we've got a massive movement with a lot of people. I mean, Mike Stone and the Baileys and Alex Zek and a bunch of other people that is on top of this this topic, and they're trying to get the best information out there. But what I don't see from them, and I don't know if this frustrates you or not, but it frustrates the hell out of me, is the fact that I don't ever discuss the work that Eleni did. And it kind of is similar to the things that you guys went through back then, because nobody wanted to give Eleni exposure. And to this day, that same attitude has been pulled through. I've only ever heard Alex Zek discuss the Perth group in a bit more detail, but nobody really goes into what they've discussed or what they've published. And even, I mean, the thing that frustrates the hell out of me is Eleni wrote HIV, A Virus Like No Other, which is a brilliant paper. And it also goes into a lot of detail on those two 1997 papers. But nobody talks about that. Mark Bailey actually went out and wrote Virology, Farewell to Virology. And that's the thing circulating the whole time. Every post you see on Twitter or on Substack or on people's websites is just Mark's.
I think we lost Dirk.
Yeah, I was just about to ask if you guys also lost audio. Dirk, if you're still there.
Just remember to unmute if you're ready to speak, Anthony.
Yeah, you cut out there for a second there.
Just saying, we lost you a minute there, Dirk.
Sorry, did you get my question or not, Anthony?
Nope.
Yeah, so my question is, doesn't it frustrate people do not discuss the brilliant work of Eleni? Because there's very little people in this movement that discuss her work.
Absolutely. And I agree. I mean, but even going back to even going back to the HIV/AIDS era, which was really my war. You know, like you guys are sort of talking about the second, and I'm talking about the First World War. Even then, it was just as you're appalled, we're all appalled by the failure of many of the prominent no virus contenders or at least the advocates. We were appalled by their failure to acknowledge Eleni properly, because she really was the first to attack virology. Far as I know, and but even in the First World War, as it were, in the civil war between the AIDS dissidents and the revival of I wouldn't even call it the revival, because it was really quite a different organization with a different focus. But even in that time, I mean, it was just atrocious that the Copernicus, I mean, the Nicholas Copernicus of our movement, the original like shining star, was being sidelined and even suppressed, you know, not permitted to talk to what she wanted at conferences by Crow. And then when she appointed me at one point to speak for her at a conference, when a so-called RA, Rethinking AIDS conference, and Crow, gunned that down. Continues. I mean, you've got all these new players. I don't know to what extent Tom Cowan acknowledges Eleni. Not that I can see. Stefan Lanka acknowledges her, fulsomely. Kaufman, I don't think so. The Baileys, I don't know. I don't really know this stuff. I mean, I can confirm that Val Turner, Eleni's collaborator, he once emailed me with a link to one of Sam Bailey's videos, and he did so, you know, with approval. To what extent they've acknowledged Eleni's like seminal, foundational work, I don't know. But you know, broadly speaking, I share your frustration. I share your sort of dismay that Eleni's not better and more fully acknowledged, because she really got the ball rolling. She is the Copernicus of the whole shit. You know, I mean, you know, everybody talks about Galileo in relation to you know, knocking over the geocentric theory of the universe, but Galileo himself, you know, acknowledged Copernicus. It all began with Copernicus, and this is why we really should acknowledge Eleni. But beside the fact that she did all this foundational work, I mean, her papers are just so marvelous to read. They're so clear. I've often remarked that, you know, to read Eleni Papadopoulos' writing, to read the Perth Group's writing, of course, all hers, you know, it's like listening to Bach. It's so subtle. It's so, she was just so very brilliant. The way she marshaled the facts, the way she then stacked them all up, you know, argued the case, referenced everything. It was just stupendous.
You know, it is very frustrating for me as well. And I'm glad that both of you spoke about this. I know some of the people that we've mentioned will say, you know, well, we have talked about this. And here's the thing. It gets very briefly mentioned in passing, and maybe a link or two provided in like a Substack article or something like that. And that's it. And I think that the reason that is done is so that when we have conversations like this, they have something to fall back on. You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, well, I have actually talked about this. Well, no, you kind of haven't, you know, but we could write books with people like RFK Jr. and endorse that, but, you know, not go into depth about Eleni and the Perth Group. And I have noticed that, you know, when we talk about Stefan Lanka, I feel like that guy kind of keeps his distance. I could be wrong. You know what I mean? But it is a pattern I've noticed, and there could be a reason for that. But again, I could be wrong about that as well. But it's just very interesting.
When you say Lanka has kept his distance, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, Lanka sort of went off on his. Lanka learned everything about virology from Eleni. Eleni once told me that, you know, he in a joking way, he nearly broke Deutsche Bank with all the cost of all the trunk calls for hours to her in Australia. But Lanka then moved on and attacked virology generally, which Eleni never did. She always stuck with HIV. I think I've discussed this before in this space, or maybe in a private conversation with Dirk. But Eleni just put all her laser focus on HIV and argued the case against the existence of HIV from within the virology paradigm. Whereas Stefan Lanka, took it on generally. Yeah, focusing on measles, which is like a crucial place to begin historically. So, and I know that Eleni, before she died, she spoke, and what she had to say was recorded, and Rod Noll has a recording, not yet released, but anyway. Recently, very recently, within the last couple of weeks. Turner told me that much of the, or a substantial part of the talk of what she said, basically, you know, on her way out, very ill, much of what you said had to do with acknowledging Stefan Lanka's own acknowledgement of her work. In other words, she was grateful to him for acknowledging her contribution. I think that is a way of pointing up her distress that others hadn't done so. I mean, this David Crowe character, I mean, he would write papers and he would argue stuff, and you know, he'd be standing on her shoulders but not acknowledging that everything he knew and said came directly from her. So
I was just speaking in terms of in the current, you know, post-COVID atmosphere and things like that. The reason I said that is because, you know, we hear about Lanka, but we don't really see him in this sphere as much as we see people, you know, like, you know, Cowan and Kaufman and the Baileys and things like that. That's what I meant. Like, it seems that he kind of prefers to relegate himself somewhat in the background and not be so upfront and in this discussion with a lot of people.
Correct. He's not part of this current discussion, but it's not like he's inactive.
I agree.
So last time I checked, he's got some publication going. He's active in his own world, as it were, and he's, you know, he's popular. He's got a network of supporters, and he's busy and focused and far from retired, but he's not thrashing this stuff out with us in these spaces. True.
I think that's wise on his part too, because just simply for some of the stuff that we've discussed or bounced around, not just here on this space, but you know, DPL and I, and you know, a couple others, you know, we have questions and things, and I think that while that's happening, it's probably a good idea to do, you know, basically what Lanka's doing: focus and keep your head down and make sure that you're still doing, you know, your work, but not so much attaching yourself, you know, publicly to everyone else's. So
I'm sorry to say I lost you, but I seem to have dropped the signal, or I'm not sure, but I didn't hear everything there.
No, that's
sorry,
fine.
Anthony. I just.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I took Anthony down from speaker because I couldn't hear him. Sorry, I had to jump between accounts. We're grateful for people like yourself, Anthony. Otherwise, this entire history would have been lost. And I mean, you and Rod has done so much work to document all of this stuff. And if it wasn't for you, we would have lost all of this. And I mean, there's a lot we can learn from you guys. And especially the David Crowe character. Maybe you want to tell people on this recording where they can find the work, and just a brief explanation of what he's done. The most impactful is probably we recorded where Eleni told you that he's destroyed the AIDS dissident movement.
Yeah, you know, I'm notorious in the country and abroad too. I'm notorious as a so-called AIDS denialist. But what's not as well known is that I put as much energy into the internal struggles that we had. And apart from the polemics that I used to write and publish, I thought it was like infinitely important for the future, you know, for future struggles. I thought it was infinitely important to record as comprehensively as possible the history of the AIDS dissident movement, and I did that in my 6-part history of RA or Rethinking AIDS, and it's all published. You can find it on a dedicated page called "The Unbelievable Mediocrity of David Crowe: Why Rethinking AIDS Has the President It Deserves." To find it,
you just go down, just get into the right column. It's a very old-fashioned design, but just get into the right column of my TIG, my treatment information group webpage, tig.org.za, tig.org.za, Z-A. And go to the right column, and you can click on the link there, and the history is there, as well as a lot of other materials that were exchanged at the time. So there's a comprehensive history of the internal conflict and archive of the memoranda and the emails and everything that was being exchanged at the time, including Crowe's defenses of his misconduct. It's all there. So it's not just the one-sided barrage.
So Anthony, maybe a tough question and you can decline to answer it, but I'm eager to find out, because I've asked Celia Farber myself, why she hasn't interviewed people like Eleni and Stefan Lonka, and why she always tend to find herself on the wrong side of history. Back then, she backed Peter Duisberg and David Crowe. And more recently, she's been seen backing RFK Jr. So maybe your opinion about why she continues to find herself on the wrong side of history?
Hey. Well, I have some ideas about this. I just want to... You know, maybe she'll listen to this, and it'll be kind of awkward. I just want to say this, that there was a time when, you know, across the ocean, Celia Farber and I were very tight. I mean, across the ocean, you know, we were exchanging, we were talking all the time, long phone calls and many emails and exchanging materials and so on. It seemed to me that Celia always wanted... the AIDS. I'm being brutally frank now. It seemed to me that she wanted the AIDS dissident movement to be a kind of a family. You know, she wanted the warmth of being part of an army for good, but a very sort of friendly, warm, family kind of affair. The trouble is that there were radical contradictions between us, which were successfully managed in the beginning until the revival of the RA thing, and then it was decided to now pick and run with the Duisberg line. It seemed to me also that Celia, she loved Duisberg. I mean, Duisberg is a great guy. I mean, he's very fond of me, you know, insisted that I sit next to him at the dinner table at the first and second meetings of the AIDS panel, Baggy's AIDS panel things in South Africa. You know, he loved my work. It's wonderful things to say about it. Duisberg was a very, very personally charismatic, likable, witty, an entertaining man. You know, everyone loved Peter, even though we believe that he misconducted himself very seriously. And Celia just sort of, I think Celia remained personally loyal to Peter and, didn't want to break with him or reprove him for his misconduct. And I can report that although she stuck with the Crowe faction, she did break with Crowe later on and said something like, you know, you were right after all, or something along those lines. That was the burden of what she conveyed to me. Now, as far as RFK goes, well, again, RFK is he's an unusual fellow. Charismatic, kind of a handsome politician, all that stuff. And I think Celia was sort of drawn to that. I understand that she did a lot of research for him. My suspicion, just from reading, from like on a textual and doing a textual analysis, I think that Celia was the principal author or the main researcher of RFK Jr.'s Nevarapine chapter. I don't know. She seems to be drawn to these charismatic men. Whereas in my case, I was just more just ruthlessly interested, coldly, brutally interested in the truth and telling the truth and getting the truth out and not being interested in the personalities and the feelings, you know. And I know that even though I'm like such a friendly guy and everything, but I know that like Celia and others regarded me as like demonic, you know, like as like they loathed me because I was so savagely uncompromising and hard in my line, in my intolerance of what Crow was doing and so on. So I don't know, I've just been speaking around the thing a bit. I hope I might have shed some light on the possible reasons why Celia has made the wrong call repeatedly. You know, I watched her a couple of clips of she appears in Bobby and Robert Kennedy's Real Anthony Fauci movie, the first one, and yeah, she presented very well. You know, I thought she did very, very well, and nothing she said was offside. In other words, she didn't put a foot wrong. She sort of tread. What she said was fine, and I thought, maybe she's coming round. But then again, I went looking for any other possible presentations or talks, and I saw she gave a talk somewhere in America, and she was talking about republishing her book. What was it called? Anyway, she published a book, and it was what she had to say at that little talk. It was full of sort of Duisburg and, you know, and HIV being a harmless virus, and it's all too terrible, man. I don't know what's the real problem. Eleni said she just wrote her off. Eleni said that Celia is incurable, because she tried so hard to sort of bring around, because, you know, we wanted Celia on her side. I mean, Celia's earlier writing really was fantastic. You know, it was really, I thought it was wonderful. Her early AZT writing in particular. We wanted her on our side, you know, but, you know, she stuck with the other guys and she kept making the wrong call, like you say.
And then on another note, Anthony, you and I and a few other people have also tried to make Mike Stone see the truth. And I know you didn't like David Crowe at all. And it seems like Mike Stone has, I don't know, took it upon himself to honor a guy like David Crowe. To the point where Mike Stone actually blocked you. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, because, I mean, we did try and make Mike Stone see reason, but it doesn't seem like he wanted to come around.
Yeah, didn't like David Crowe. I loathed Crowe. I really loathed Crowe. It was like there was almost like a spiritual element to it. And I used to say, you know, if that guy was in the same room, I would reduce him to jelly with a baseball bat. I felt a murderous rage to that guy because he was so sleazy. He was so sleazy, you know. I'm used to fencing in like in an honourable way. I mean, I'm a trial lawyer, so I'm a bit tired right now, so I'm not as coherent as I should be. But you know, I'm used to like clear cut arguments, and it was impossible to engage with Crowe honestly because, well, you try to be, you know, you'd be honest, but he'd be dishonest. He'd always be evasive, and he'd use words in an abusive manner. Now, come, Mike Stone. I discovered Mike Stone's stuff on Facebook, of all places, and I made contact with him. I said, you know, you're writing incredibly good stuff here, and this is a completely unsuitable platform for publishing your stuff. You really need to get a website up and get the stuff archived in case you get shut down, as you know. Facebook is very, very unsafe and insecure place to be. If people don't like what you, the powers that be don't like what you say, they'll shut you down. And you know, I was always such an admirer of his. You know, and he always had these very pleasant exchanges and all that. And, you know, we had like a mutual fan club. And I knew from seeing his website, you know, he put like Crow like top of the list of people that he credited. But I mean, Crow was a pretender. Crow was a usurper. And then ultimately a very destructive player. And Mike Stone was just never willing to investigate the thing. He just formed, it's remarkable. I mean, he is so open-minded and clear thing to me. I mean, I know he's made some mistakes people have criticized. But I mean, he always seemed to be, had such a rigorous turn of mind. He displayed this rigor in tackling virology, which I found impressive, you know. But yet he was absolutely prejudiced, absolutely unwilling to revisit his early favorable personal impressions of Crow. And I try to bring him around. I try to demonstrate to him that he caused immense damage, that Eleni detested him and resented the harm that he'd caused. And she was very vocal about it. And an extraordinary thing, and also, I try to get Crow to Stone to understand that he'd fucked up the all-important Parenzy case in Australia. And Stone just was simply unwilling to examine the evidence. And then you would press him. One would press him, you know, in these arguments on X. And he'd always, you know, he'd like duck and dive. It was clear that he wasn't engaging in good faith. And you'd say, well, like, where's the direct evidence? But, you know, I know all about evidence. I've sent men to jail as a regional court magistrate. I've jailed men for 15 years at a time, you know, 15 years a shot, several times, you know. I'm good with evidence. I won't condemn somebody unless the evidence is airtight, you know, beyond reasonable doubt. And I stacked up all the evidence against Crow, and Stone was unwilling to consider it. And he was always just like fucking around, you know. He'd thrash around. He'd argue using Talmudic pilpul, which is using language in argument, not to get to the point, but in a power game, you know, to defeat you with a deluge of words or rhetorical tricks, never getting there, you know, not engaging you head on, or ducking and diving in a sleazy way, like Crow. So this is so eventually I just lost patience and I started getting rude, you know, just getting bluntly rude, because I wanted to convey my contempt for the manner in which he was not discussing, you know, I won't say discussing, but like not discussing what I was bringing to his attention. And and then he blocked me. But I mean, I didn't care. I'd written him off already. And I've now also just muted or blocked her. I don't think I blocked her, just muted. I'm not interested. I'm no longer interested in Mike Stone. I'm no longer interested. He's like out of my frame.
I had a very similar kind of path that I walked when it came to Mike Stone. So your frustration is very understandable, Anthony. In the beginning, I found a lot of his writings very useful, very well thought out. Back when I was on, it was called the Starfire Codes podcast, he was like one of the first people that were on my list to have on an interview. You know what I mean? So there's that, you know, for anybody who has been watching the argument between Stone and some of us in the no virus movement. And for me, it was the same unwillingness to either question or thoroughly investigate people, you know, like Crow or even others that he kind of has on that pedestal. And before you came into the conversation earlier, this is what I was discussing, was that we kind of traded one set of people and information for a second set. And then once we get attached to them, we don't want to question them if we have a favor for them. And that, you know, we can't keep doing that. We have to
this is what I, correct me if I'm wrong, when you were talking about politics earlier, instead of the existential, you know, huge media political influence, it's this kind of internal politics, really, that can have the potential to destroy a movement, or at the very least, you know, take away from its overarching message. What would you say about that, Anthony?
I agree completely. Nothing to add. You said it perfect. You said it completely.
I want to bring up Revelation too, because they've had the request up here for a while. Give me a second.
Yeah, Kristen, you can bring them up. Just make sure they're not here to troll. I'm just afraid that's probably Saint Strand's 8th account. I don't know Revelation, but we can give him a go if you feel like you won't be trolling.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, anyone trolling can just get kicked out. So hopefully we have something good to add to the conversation here, because we don't have time for that shit.
Now, I just wanted to add, Anthony, you probably have seen Eleni's breakdown of the two 1997 papers. And yes, I repeat that in almost every space, because I mean, that is actually the end of virology. That was such a brutal breakdown of the quackery that is virology. It is unbelievable. And what I saw in this whole Mike Stone debate was, we actually had a fallout in August, I think it was last year, August, September last year. And what I found was that Val Turner actually wrote a comment below Mike Stone's articles on his website. And he told Mike, you know what, this is great work, but have you ever considered the two 1997 papers that Eleni discussed? And have you ever considered doing any work on that? And he said, no, you will look into that. And that was August of 2022. And we had a massive fallout about that same paper in August, September of 2023. And he still hasn't reviewed that work. So I don't know what's your opinion about the two 1997 papers. But for me, anybody that's got a fairly good understanding of what's going on with isolation and proteomics and all this crock of shit, they just need to review that work that Eleni did, and they would see that, I mean, the whole field is a quack fest.
Well, correct. I mean, you summed up perfectly, completely, and nothing to add. I agree with you completely. I don't know why Stone won't take up Turner's advice to review those papers. I'm at a loss. I just don't know.
DPL, do you remember a couple months back when we had someone asking me on behalf of Andy Kaufman for those 97 papers? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. I made that horse meme, and the last one was the two 1997 papers. And for anybody that hasn't reviewed those papers yet, or the work that Eleni did on it, I would encourage you to go and have a look at it, because, I mean, you know, that completely destroys virology. And it goes a lot deeper than that, because we're currently tackling genetics and genome sequencing and all this other stuff. But those two 1997 papers proved without a shadow of a doubt that infected and uninfected cultures are exactly the same. So this method of isolation using cell cultures is blown out of the water. So, no.
Yeah, so that's why I brought that up, is because I passed on that information. I know it was given to him, but somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't seen him talk about it either.
Yeah, no, it's a funny state we find ourselves in, and that's why I like talking to Anthony about this stuff. I'm just trying to figure out what's going on, because like he says, you would always try and put your sharpest blade in the front of the battle, and I'm at a loss of words of why no one has picked up the Perth Group's work and started discussing that. I mean, I lost my shit because of this last year, middle of last year, and to this day the only person I've heard touch on it a bit more is Alex Zek. Nobody else has picked up the Perth Group's work.
Yeah, and to touch on what you said too, with the like we've kind of already dismantled virology pretty adequately. I think moving on to other junk sciences like genetics and things like that are going to be what, hopefully helps to chip at that foundation and sort of, topple the house of cards, because that's what's propping it up. People like to use things, like genetics and PCR and all this other stuff, and that's kind of what they use to reinforce the virus lie. And once you get to the foundation of that, and you see that that is also, I mean, it's like deja vu. If you know or are familiar with the isolation processes that are, used in virology, and then you start to see how they, make the assertion that, things like nucleotides exist to even have DNA be a thing. It's kind of like a slap in the face, Kossel, who is another establishment Nobel Prize winner, and I say this all the time, I say it till I'm blue in the face. Where did Kossel get his nucleotides? Seabird guano. Well, that's bird shit. Then we have things like hydrolyzed calf thymus and just all this other stuff. And when you start to unravel and understand that stuff, it's almost like you're being trolled by scientists. I don't know how people think they're actually working with the quote unquote building blocks of life in that regard.
Yeah, I agree 100%, Kristen. And that's another thing I like about Omar's group, Omar Jordan. Yes, he's done a lot of work on exposing this horseshit. And he says the main idea, and I know everybody's not gatekeepers, but one of the traits that I see a gatekeeper as is they would just keep you stuck on one subject. And what you just mentioned, the field of genetics, is probably the first or the best step to take from where we are now. And yeah, we shouldn't just be stuck on no virus. I mean, that's a very easy lie to dismantle. And yeah, I know there's a bunch of guys doing a lot of good work on genetics and exposing that.
Who are the best guys on this? Because, I'm very, very interested in this field. I never got that far, and I realized that I kind of stopped. I kind of moved out of the thing with HIV, with virology generally. But that's kind of where I stopped. I was aware that the DNA theory was insecure. That the central dogma. Is that right? The DNA, RNA, protein, all that is unsound. But I never really plumbed it, and then I've become aware that there's a lot of action and a lot of interest and a lot of activity around this. And I think Jamie, you're onto this big time. I don't know who else. I'm a little bit like I say, I'm like a veteran of the First World War. Smoking my pipe in my conservatory, drinking tea. I've lost touch with the current action, and I know that it's gone way beyond virology. While I'm talking, if I might abuse the occasion, if you'll indulge me here, I'm very, very interested to know from anybody who might know. I suspect Jamie is the best man here. I'm very interested to know when anthropologists say things like a certain people can be, traced to a certain part of Europe via by the to the DNA, and if DNA theory is completely unsound, is garbage. Like, what are
Well,
they talking about?
a lot of
Really?
that, Anthony, I would say is a lot of it is public record access and guesswork. You know what I mean? Because when people, excuse me, when people send in their swab to DNA companies, like 23andMe and things like that, and as an aside, if you look into who owns some of these companies, that's a whole nother story, you know what I mean? But so when people are sending in their quote unquote genetic material, what they're getting back is easily accessed through an extensive public record search. And some of the time they'll have like little questionnaires and you'll have to answer a few questions if you have any relevant information about your background and things like that. And there have been plenty of instances where people have, you know, sent in samples that have yielded, like it's supposed to be the same sample from the same person, but it's yielded different results just based on different ways of answering questions. People have sent in their dog's DNA, you know, so really, you tell me what they're finding or looking for, because it's not always very accurate. It's a lot of it is public record finding, I would say.
What about paternity testing? My last acting appointment as a magistrate, I used to do these maintenance inquiries, and sometimes the guy would say it's not me, and then blood tests would be done and the blood would be tested for DNA, and then sometimes the test would say the man is absolutely excluded as the father, or the test would come back and say there's a 99.99 chance that he is the father. And I realize we're moving a little bit off topic here, but I'm completely fascinated by this, and what I want to know is, like, what the hell is going on? Was there any value to these tests at all? You know, what were they looking for? What were they finding? What is going on here?
So to answer your question with the court paternity test, right? It can go both ways, right? So it could, you know, miraculously connect and put families together, but it can also have, you know, pretty devastating damage to the families that have requested the testing or had the tests, you know, forced upon them by a judge. And it can yield really bad results too, you know, because what the DNA test is extracting is a sample and then amplifying it until the same, you know, quote unquote markers are found in every human. And then that turns up on their testing strips and then they use that. So this is something that DPL was talking about, Omar Jordan. He goes into this pretty well with like DNA fingerprinting as well, and it's a very similar instance where basically they are using the power of the court to make or break a case according to their favor in many cases. So that's definitely something to think about. Jamie, did you want to have to add to that? You're the man on this.
Oh, hey guys, happy Saturday. Sorry, I'm currently sanding a floor, but I'll come in and just explain quickly to Anthony specifically, because I can kind of touch upon some of the core aspects and the findings in terms of DNA, because there's basically no blinded accuracy tests of DNA. I can send you some information afterwards, Anthony, but I'll describe it. I've touched upon it, so I'm sure it'll be a bit boring for everybody else, but I'll just go through it again because it's really quite eye-opening in terms of legal jurisdiction. There's a chap in America who was affiliated with the O.J. Simpson trial, a guy called Barry Sheck, and he was so aghast at the inaccuracies that he was seeing in forensics that he set up his own group called the Innocence Project in the US, looking at what he deemed to be representing people in the court system who he believed to be erroneously charged based on faulty DNA evidence. And he went to the three-letter agency in America responsible for forensics and ergo per paternity tests. And he asked them, have you got any blinded accuracy studies of genetics, of DNA, of these forensics test that you're carrying out and you're convicting people with. And they said, no, we have no blinded accuracy tests, i.e. we take a pool of people and we take a known to us person and take their DNA and you find it. So you as a genetics lab, as an accredited genetics lab, find this DNA. We know who it is. You tell us who it is. They didn't have any. So he forced them to do it. And he gave them a mixture of a sample, three people in a Petri dish, and told 107 different labs to try and find the perpetrator. The options were the perpetrator is in the dish, it isn't in the dish, or they don't know. And six out of 107 labs got the right answer. Only six out of 107. So less than 10% said that the sample, the DNA sample, was not in the dish. And he went further than that because he represented a man at court who he believed was falsely accused based on his forensics evidence. He believed that the judge was biased and knew the geneticist personally and believed that he was privy to this knowledge, that the geneticist was privy to the knowledge that the judge basically just thought the guy was guilty, and so accused him of skewing the results, and so gave the same DNA sample to 18 separate labs, and only one of those labs confirmed with the initial result. Again, less than 10%. So when you're talking about, you know, actual accuracy tests, and this applies to paternity tests, obviously paternity tests are even, even kind of easier to defraud, because it's usually only between one or two people. I mean, unless the lady has been a bit promiscuous, but with paternity tests, you see all sorts of accuracy inconsistencies coming back. I think one of them was twins or something, I think, coming back, and both of them said they were the opposite sex. But to touch upon how they get some sort of semblance of feedback, when you're talking about Ancestry&Me or 23andMe, every single one of them is owned by YouTube or a giant informatics company. So basically, you know, everybody in the Western world that has a mobile phone, that has a bank account, that has, you know, any sort of tie into the system is immediately traceable via informatics. And the more and more people that feed in to that system, the more they cover people who, you know, the Amish and things like that, who are not, you know, directly related to the beast system, but somewhat vicariously intercalated. And just the more people that kind of sift into the informatics net, the closer they can be to finding, you know, that these very rare occasions that the stories that you hear about, oh, this person was my long lost cousin that nobody ever knew about, you know, they're very rare. But when you actually look, the times that they get it wrong are like 99%, and then they come away with these rare occasions that they're finding people. Hopefully that kind of whets your appetite, Anthony, to kind of look further into it. As I say, I can give you the article about Barry Scheck. I'll send it to you on here, because it's quite eye-opening, really. And that was the other thing, is that I started to actually interview every single geneticist that I can come past, and I asked them almost exactly the same question. These are trained, accredited, and seasoned professionals within the genetics community. And I say to them, if I took a pool of 100 different animals, doesn't matter what they are, a newt, a donkey, a kestrel, whatever, okay, and I take a DNA sample from one of them, can you tell me what it is? So I have a pool of 100 animals, and invariably they say one of two things. Oh, of course I can. And then the next question is, can you show me any sort of paper where they do this? I.e. any sort of paper where it's, again, some sort of accuracy study where we would know, where it would be bloody obvious, you know, whether you, what you were doing was correct or not, or accurate, or anything. But there isn't a paper in existence, according to my knowledge and the hundreds of geneticists that I've asked, where this, you know, very, very simple accuracy study has ever been done. So, you know, a gut feeling is that it's a crock of shit.
Yes, it, honestly, you know, Jamie, I think that a lot of it is to DNA genetics. It really just reinforces the belief in authority in many cases. And since we're on the subject of, like, you know, the repeating pandemic cycle, it largely contributes to that as well. You know, how you were talking about the owners of these companies and stuff, that 23andMe is owned by Ann Wojcicki, and she is married to the co-founder of Google. And she's listed on the World Economic Forum page. You know what I mean? So if you look into other companies, it's a very similar case or instance of them all kind of being a part of that quote unquote globalist cabal or whatever the fuck you want to call it. You know what I mean? But, you know, it is relevant because, again, if we're talking about this repeating cycle and stuff, the DNA genetics paradigm is what contributes largely to virology.
Agreed, Kristen. And I think everybody that's been on the front lines of this fighting this horseshit has seen that they've gradually changed their tune from the basic cell culture experiment, which they call isolation, to genome sequencing and PCR and all this other crock of shit. So it is, in my view, like you say, on the topic of repeating pandemic cycles, if we want to stop this crock of shit, we need to understand that topic as well. Otherwise, the next pandemic or the next hoax is going to be led by this technology.
Yeah, and in both cases, it's the exact same thing for extraction methods. You're exposing something to harsh chemicals, using ultracentrifugation, extreme heating and or cooling. You know, how can we expose things to this type of conditions and think it's not going to be altered just by that exposure alone? It's batshit crazy.
Yeah, and to get back to a topic that I like to discuss is the gatekeepers. It's astounding to see that instead of pointing out frauds like Kerry Mullis, who was the leader in this field, developing, they say, the PCR, instead of ousting this fraud, our movement praised him only because he said one sentence in an interview where it sounded like he doubted whether the PCR can give you a diagnosis or not. And I mean, if you dig into Kerry Mullis, you'd see that he's most likely a plant and he's definitely a fraud. And instead of our movement ousting this horseshit, we've praised people like himself and Peter Duisberg. But yeah, I don't know if there's anything you guys want to add to that, but we've been going for an hour and a half. If there's nothing else, I think we can cut it off there.
Yeah, I think we've covered a lot. Anthony, do you want to add anything else?
No, I'm good. Nothing to add. Thanks, Kristen.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for joining, Kristen and Anthony. Always nice chatting to you guys. And also, Jamie, thanks for your contributions. We'll definitely schedule another space to discuss this topic further.
Sounds good. Thank you, everyone, for listening. You guys all have a fantastic weekend.